Tax Update for Saturday, October 21st, 2006. Welcome to the Tax Update for Saturday, October 21st, 2006. This week, we're going to take a look at the IRS's response to Take That to Private Annuities. The IRS issues proposed regulations in this area. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm any items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio podcast. Such prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CPE presentation for which a fee is charged. This podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Limeburg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Well, last week when I started the podcast, I mentioned that not much seemed to have happened in tax developments last week. Well, this week the IRS and the courts are beginning to make up for that. In fact, we've had a lot of activity this week from the IRS cleaning up some loose ends they've had on various issues. And we're going to talk about one of those things they did this week, one of the projects they ended up finishing up and kicking out as a proposed regulation that may have some very significant impact on some people and some transactions that have been that are involved or some methods that people have used in the past for tax planning purposes. But before we get there, let's talk about a few of the other issues that were taken up this week, just so you're aware they're there. The IRS this week announced the new 2007 dollar limitations on compensation and benefits. Now, these are the annual limitations for things like the compensation you consider for a qualified plan, the annual additions to an account under Section 415 that you can add to your qualified plan, the elective deferral amounts for 401k plans, etc. The annual compensation limit for 2007 will go up from $220,000 in 2006 to $225,000 next year. The dollar limitation on annual benefits on a defined benefit plan will raise from $175,000 maximum amount to $180,000. The 415 limitation for contributions to a defined contribution plan will go up by $1,000 from $44,000 to $45,000. The definition of a highly compensated employee amount of $100,000 stays the same under 414Q1B, but the definition for a key employee under a top-heavy plan under 416I1A i goes from $140,000 to $145,000. The limit on elective deferrals under 401K and 403B plans raises by $500 next year from $15,000 to $15,500. And that same rule applies to deferrals under 457B deferred compensation plans. Now, this was all found in information release 2006-162 that was released by the IRS on the 18th of October. As well, the IRS this week released the proposed and temporary regulations on the same day as the notice for the plan numbers. Proposed and temporary regulations dealing with Congress's new rules for the limitations on W-2 wages for the domestic production deduction under Section 199. And those proposed regulations talk about how we allocate and determine how much of our wages, our W-2 wages, are to be considered related to domestic production. And the IRS generally says that essentially you're allowed to use any reasonable method that is satisfactory to the Secretary, which is kind of redundant almost. If it's satisfactory to the Secretary, it's probably okay, but, you know, what is satisfactory to the Secretary? So the IRS does provide safe harbors. Now, there really is going to be, for any particular taxpayer, one safe harbor. It will depend on the method you are using to compute domestic production activity income. Those who compute domestic production activity income under the 861 method, which is the method required if you don't qualify for one of the two simpler methods, or those who compute under the simplified deduction methods will use one safe harbor that basically looks at the amount of wages that have been considered in computing QPI versus total wages, takes that ratio, multiplies that by W-2 wages, which, oh, by the way, may not be the same number as the number you deducted, as we understand rather quickly if you take a look at these rules. but that'll be the ratio to determine how much of our W-2 wages count as production wages. If you qualify to use the Small Business Simplified Overall Method, then we allocate W-2 wages based upon the ratio of domestic production gross receipts to total gross receipts. Now, these are proposed regulations. These proposed and temporary regulations that are identical to the proposed regulations were issued in Treasury Decision 9293. The temporary regulations are 1.199-2T, 5T, and 7T. Now, in Notice 2006-96 issued on the 19th of October, the IRS gave some guidance for the special rules we find under Section 170F that deal with the qualified appraiser rules as to what is a qualified appraisal, what is a qualified appraiser. And we get various definitions here that are going to be required, plus a special addition to the appraiser's report where the appraiser is going to have to take specific notice of the fact that they understand that the report could be subject to penalty under 6695A. That is a new special penalty provisions that can apply to appraisers when their appraisal ends up resulting in an understatement of tax. Again, this was notice 2006-96 issued today, issued actually it'd be Thursday, today I'm recording this thing, by the IRS. And then finally, this, for those who are hoping the Second Circuit would come up with a different result, in the case of the Rudkin Testamentary Trust, the Second Circuit affirmed the unanimous tax court decision in that case from last year, which essentially said that in that case, trust investment advisory fees were subject to the 2% floor under Section 61A. Now, the interesting aside is the Second Circuit actually ends up imposing a test that is stricter than any test we've seen before for being able to take the deduction without the 2% haircut. And in the opinion, which was written up in a special notice that was sent out to subscribers of Steve Lineberg's mailing list, it was noted that the opinion holds specifically, and I quote, "We believe the plain text of Section 67E1 requires that we determine with certainty that costs could not have been incurred if the property were held by an individual." That's a somewhat different test than we saw the tax court apply in this case, where they look to whether individuals would ordinarily incur these types of expenses, and certainly is very different from the test that the Sixth Circuit used in the O'Neill case, where they allowed a deduction without the 2% haircut by the argument that the fees were incurred because of the trustee's duties, even if they were of a type an individual might also incur. Now, that was the Rudkin Testamentary Trust. The Second Circuit's come down. What that means is we have now the Second Circuit, Fourth, and Federal Circuits essentially going on along with at least the tax court position on these fees. They're not generally deductible. And the O'Neill decision from the Sixth Circuit is the one that still stands out there that allowed the deduction in a case where the tax court would probably disagree with the allowance of the, in fact, did, because the tax court was reversed in O'Neill. So you take a look at that case. Now, on top of all that this week, though, we did have a very interesting set of proposed regulations the IRS brought down on a topic that I think for many of us in the tax preparation field is maybe one that we deal with on a very occasional basis or have discussed and kind of know about the technique, but maybe don't use it all the time, at least not if you're not in certain types of estate planning engagements constantly. And that is the issue of something known as a private annuity. And the IRS this week has proposed regulations that will radically change the taxation of private annuities for income tax purposes. Now, these proposed regulations are important because if they go into effect as they currently stand, they would impact private annuity arrangements that were entered into on or after October 18th of 2006. If you check your calendar, you're going to note we're past October 18th of 2006 now by the time you hear this podcast. So essentially, any agreement signed today could potentially be impacted by these proposed regulations and not by the law as it existed before then, including the IRS ruling in the area where we had in Revenue Ruling 6974 that previously governed this and ends up with a very different result than the proposed regulations end up with. Now, I think to understand this, you first have to go back and deal with what was the treatment of private annuities if you're not familiar with that treatment. Now, in my whole career as a CPA doing tax work, I've only actually seen this executed once. I've seen it discussed multiple times, but actually executed in a transaction, we actually saw it in one case. Many years ago, I saw it. And we have the tax treatment of private annuities. It's an interesting concept. A private annuity is an annuity that's basically issued to an individual by somebody other than a commercial insurance carrier. Now, I should point out before we get started that these proposed regulations will not change the treatment of things like charitable gift annuities or charitable remainder trust, that type of annuity treatment. So don't get off on the deep end about charitable annuities or those. Those are not the ones we're talking about here. The IRS was concerned with the other types, with these private annuities taxed under this old revenue ruling. And what usually happened in this case is that I owned an appreciated asset. Let's say I own a highly appreciated piece of real estate. And I'm going to sell it to my son. And my son agrees because I want to have some income for the rest of my life. I'm retired. I've got this highly appreciated piece of real estate, but what I really want is a monthly payout. My son says, Dad, I'll fix that for you. I will pay you X dollars per month as long as you live if you basically transfer that real estate to me. So I'm going to buy that piece of real estate from you for what is a lifetime annuity. Dad says, fine, and we do that. The tax treatment under Revenue Ruling 6974 is one that was a little unusual and different and probably would surprise people the first time they heard it, but there was a reason behind how this occurred. Under the private annuity rules, we had an issue about how we recovered. Clearly, there was a sale of the real estate to a third party for consideration. But the sale was not recorded and fully taxed in the instant it was sold. Well, you might think in one sense, well, yeah, it makes sense. It looks like an installment sale. Except it's not really an installment sale because we don't know what the principal will be. Or we don't know for sure. It's not like the standard note where I can pay it off or do those things. I've got to make payments every month to Dad, and what Dad has to do is keep breathing. If he does that, we keep sending him payments. So the tax treatment of this, there were litigations in the 50s on this topic, and in those cases, the courts applied the open transaction doctrine, which said essentially because we could not know what the final payment would be, that a taxpayer would first be allowed to recover his basis, so only until Sonny had paid me an amount at least equal to my basis, I would recognize no gain. After I received my basis back, then from then forward, each payment would be the gain to me, essentially. Under that theory, that would be the taxation open transaction doctrine. It was an open sale, and we didn't know the sales price until the end. Now, Revenue Ruling 6974, the IRS changes that somewhat, and the IRS integrates this treatment because not only do we have here potentially an estate tax issue, but remember, if I sell a piece of property to someone, most likely my relative, my son, and I might give him a deal and sell it to him well below fair market value, in essence, giving him a gift. Well, we have to be able to compute the gift portion of this. So the IRS came back and said, we're going to come up with a ruling that's going to integrate all of this and come up with a tax treatment. In the case of the ruling, the IRS had a taxpayer who was 74 that transferred property that had a basis of $20,000 and a fair value of $60,000 to his son in exchange for an annuity that would pay him $7,200 per year, payable in equal monthly installments of $600. So as long as Dad lived, son would pay him $600. And in exchange for that, son would get the $60,000 asset. Now, the IRS then went through a computation of what would happen. But mechanically, there would be four principals that would be involved in handling this under this ruling, and this is the taxation we've all gotten used to generally under private annuities. The gain realized on the transaction by Revenue Ruling 6974 was you compared the basis in the property with the present value of the annuity computed under the appropriate annuity valuation tables. So I would basically compute the discounted value of what I would receive at $600 per month given my age. I would compare that to the basis of the property. So comparatively, if I did an annuity that truly was worth the fair value of the property at 60 grand, then I'd have a 40 grand gain. In this case, Sonny got a deal, and the math in the ruling shows you the deal he got. But basically, Sonny got a deal at this point for paying at that rate. Therefore, there were going to be a part gain, a part sale, and part gift. As noted in number two, the excess of the fair value of the property, this is the second test we do, over the present value of the annuity is a gift for gift tax purposes. So basically, we have a gift, therefore, for the excess of the value to Son. That makes sense. Now, number three was a primary issue, and the primary thing we're going to change here. Under Revenue Ruling 6974, the gain would be reported ratably over the period of years measured by the life expectancy, and you did it based upon a portion includable in their income each year based on the annuity, so we came up with kind of a percentage to bring it in. That would be based on the annuity, so I would recognize that gain over my life expectancy. And my basis in the contract for purposes of Section 72 is the basis in the property transferred. So essentially, I would use for purposes of Section 72 in taxing the annuity, I would compute my return of principal being based upon my basis. The rest would be income, but part of that income would become capital gain over the life of the agreement, and part of it would be ordinary income. So essentially, each payment would get three pieces. We would get non-taxable return of capital, the portion of the annuity that represented my basis coming back to me, capital gain, and ordinary income from the annuity. Now, on page three of the materials that I'm going to have for this week, there is the full computation from the ruling of exactly how this worked. The important thing to remember, though, was we paid no tax up front when we executed this agreement. Even though I had exchanged property with my son, and I did not do so on an installment sale because this is an installment note. So I had exchanged an asset to him for another asset, the annuity right. It's not an asset of sorts. I still didn't have to recognize the gain, and in fact only picked up the gain using this computational method that allowed me to pick it up over my life expectancy ratably. So if I lived shorter than my life expectancy, you know, I didn't pick up all my gain. Basically, and if because I also didn't collect it all, kind of bad news. If I live longer, then I continued to pick up gain. And I would note that the old case law suggested you still might be able to argue for an open transaction doctrine. Now, the IRS was concerned because they felt, according to the notice that came along with the proposed regs, that they felt there had been inappropriate transactions being used under these rules. And that they note that many of these transactions involve private annuity contracts issued by family members or by business entities that are owned directly or indirectly by the annuitants themselves or their family members. And many of these transactions involved a variety of mechanisms that would secure the payments of the amounts due under the annuity contract. So we dressed it up as an annuity, but wasn't really. And we did various structures to make this work. Now, let's talk about a traditional structure that was often used, called the private annuity trust. And this is one of them that clearly is what the IRS was aiming at. A, quote, independent trust, unquote, would be formed and would purchase the land from Dad. Now, this Dad's problem was Sonny didn't want land. You know, Sonny could care less. That wasn't what Sonny wanted. Sonny didn't want the land. And Sonny wasn't interested in buying it from Dad, but Dad wanted to get a stream of payments. He wanted to monetize this and get some cash, and apparently it wasn't, you know, maybe it's not good rental value, whatever, we're getting rid of it. So what we're going to do, though, is defer tax on the gain. How are we going to do that? Well, I've got this buyer out here. The buyer's not interested in giving me annuity. I'm an independent buyer. I don't really want to bet on this guy's life expectancy. So what we do is we set up this trust. Dad sells the property to the trust in exchange for an annuity. Well, now we think about that transaction. Dad does not yet recognize gain because it's an annuity. He'll pick this up ratably over his life expectancy. However, the trust basis in the property is equal to its fair value because they gave him a note. And yes, there was not going to be a gift part of this transaction. They gave him a note that was equal to the fair value of the property. They basically gave him an annuity that worked out to being equal to that. The trust then turns around and sells the property to that third party and receives the cash. Now, at the trust level, there is no tax at this point because there is no gain to the trust. All the gains to Dad, and Dad's going to delay reporting it. The trust then can take the full proceeds of the sale, invest those proceeds, and then use that income plus the principal to pay its obligation to Dad on the annuity. So therefore, the trust essentially is able to give the income stream to Dad. Now, over time, obviously, the trust ends up paying tax on its income, but you get a substantial deferral of that gain, and Dad's able to fully reinvest the proceeds. The proceeds are not taxed, so we can fully reinvest the proceeds, and we defer the tax down the line. That was the private annuity trust. And if you do a Google search for private annuity trust, you'll find tons of firms that were offering to assist you in setting one up. So this was being heavily marketed. The IRS is not happy. So the IRS indicated in their proposed regs that they do not believe that either the open transaction approach or the ratable recognition of the old revenue ruling clearly reflect the income exchange for annuity. The Treasury notes specifically that contrary to the premise underlying these authorities, that in fact an annuity contract can be reasonably valued at the time it is issued. And in fact, we've been doing that quite a bit for streams of income under the code for various reasons over the past few years. It says, see generally Section 6520, or 7520, I should say, that requires use of table of value in any annuity contract for income tax purposes. And it says the fair market value as a note is going to be a question of fact, but only in rare and unusual instances will the property be considered to have no fair market value. And they're saying the annuity cannot be considered to have no value, and the general rule is when we exchange properties, in the exchange, I look at the fair values, and I can compute what that is. The IRS also notes that if you'd gotten a private annuity, if instead of, let's say, the buyer, instead of buying it from the trust, had gone out and, let's say, helped Dad fund an annuity, so I went to New York Life Insurance, and basically the proceeds that would have gone for the sale, I give to New York Life, who buys an annuity for Dad and gives that to Dad in exchange for Dad transferring the property to me as the new owner. In that situation, Dad would pay tax on the entire value of the proceeds and then would have to pick up the income only, you know, the income down the line from the annuity, the ordinary income portion, after getting a step up in basis in that annuity because he'd use the full proceeds to become his investment in a contract under Section 72. The IRS believes the result should be identical whether a private annuity or a commercial annuity is used in the transaction. So what the IRS proposes to do is treat a private annuity as if the property had been sold for cash, tax it at that point, and then treat it as if that cash was then used to purchase the private annuity. What that means is all of the gain is triggered instantly on the execution of the annuity and the transfer of the property to son or to whoever it may be, including the trust. Suddenly, there is no deferral. Now, this is a radical change from the way we had had the law taxed before. And the IRS recognizes that this may catch a few people unawares, including people that weren't doing transactions that really had the IRS terribly upset. Now, I should note, the IRS gives a limited reprieve for what they consider to be transactions that were in the spirit of the old revenue ruling. They are still going to get rid of the option to use that old revenue ruling. They're going to get rid of that treatment. But if you had a transaction in the spirit of the ruling, the way they view it, then they're going to give you a temporary break and allow you to close out as long as you get your deal done and get everything completed by next April. You've got a 6-month deferral. They will allow you to still treat it under the old revenue ruling rather than having to treat it under the new rules. How do you get this relief? To qualify for the relief, a transaction has to meet 3 tests. First, the issuer of the annuity contract must be an individual. There goes the private annuity trust. The obligations under the contract cannot be secured either directly or indirectly. If the IRS finds you have secured the repayment in some way, shape, or form, you're under the new rules, not the old. And third and most important, the property transferred in exchange for the contract is not sold or otherwise disposed of by the transferee during the 2-year period beginning on the date of the exchange. And for these purposes, a disposition includes without limitation a transfer to any trust, whether a grantor trust or a revocable trust or any other trust, or to any other entity, even if solely owned by the transferor. Now, that is an interesting provision there as to what exactly that means. It seems to suggest disregarded entities won't be disregarded under this test. So that presents another interesting problem and potentially a minefield someone could step in. If you qualify for this reprieve, you have 6 months to get everything right and close the transaction. Once that period is done, these transactions as well will be fully taxable as soon as they are executed. The point of all this? The private annuity pretty much is dead in the form we were used to seeing it before and the ways we used to use it. At this point, you will have a private annuity only, to be honest, if there is a significant non-tax reason to have a private annuity, at least as I view this matter at this point. It is important, though, to recognize that even though many of us may not have dealt with this all the time, it was one of those concepts, as I said, that was often mentioned and one of those you knew in the back of your mind. The thing to remember at this point, if you did deal with it regularly, is now things have changed radically. And therefore, if somebody's mentioning this, you better say, wait, hold things, the law has now changed or potentially changed. And I should say potentially, because as it stands right now, officially, the old revenue ruling is still the law. 6974 is the law as of today, because what we have is a proposed regulation. However, we've been put on notice that the IRS intends for this proposed regulation, once it goes final, to have an effective date before today. So right now you sit in a twilight zone. It would be extremely dangerous to go forward presuming that the old revenue ruling is going to apply to your transaction if you don't meet the safe harbor exception for the 6-month extension, unless you really, really, really made it clear to the client that there is a very strong chance the IRS will change the reg, and then we're going to be dealing with having to fight the battle of whether the IRS had the authority to change it and whether the regulation is valid and all those issues that, quite frankly, most of our clients would prefer not to fight. As I was told years ago by an attorney, most of my clients don't want to be mentioned in continuing education courses. And that's true of most of my clients as well. And I suspect most of yours. So this is an important deal to keep in the back of your mind and to keep an eye on. Now, as I mentioned before, next week I'm going to be in Ohio doing some continuing education presentations. As it turns out, I will be doing 2 for the Ohio Society. It turns out we didn't get enough people to go to Zanesville, so Zanesville's off the list. But I will be speaking on Wednesday in Cleveland. I will be speaking on Thursday in Mansfield, Ohio. So I'll be in those 2 cities, traveling through Ohio and taking a look. I'm also going to do a presentation for a local office of a firm on Tuesday, so I will be in Ohio beginning the early part of next week. So I'll be running around Ohio for a while and getting those pieces together. The following week, I will be doing a presentation in Kansas City on that Thursday. So I'll be kind of bouncing around a bit and doing various oddball and strange presentations on continuing education. All of these presentations deal with tax updates of one sort or another. Doing two slightly different courses on tax updates, but still doing tax updates in both locations. So I'm going to be out and about. So that does mean next week's podcast may come up at a rather strange time, because on Friday I'm going to kind of be around and in transit, and I hope to get a chance to record a podcast next week, and but it may not be recorded until the weekend. So if this goes up a day or so late, you'll kind of know why. This has been the Tax Update Podcast for October the 21st. Reminder, Tax Update Podcast is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Visit them and take a look at their subscription options. They have an awful lot of very useful email information coming out to you, especially in weeks like this when we have all these nice little developments coming out of this. Take a look, consider subscribing to their services. This has been the Tax Update.